It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
Guys, this is our first ever attempt at recording a remote full-length episode.
Wow.
And it's so weird. It's so weird because when I was preparing for this day, I was still picturing it with our regular setup. I was like, Maya will be across from me at the desk and we'll do all the things we do. And then I was like, just kidding. She's very far away.
Gorgeous in-person banter. Hannah and I are love. We keep FaceTiming like every day. It's really ridiculous and stupid, but awesome.
I think this is maybe going to improve the banter. We'll have more things to say to one another.
Sometimes I'm like, should I call Hannah? And then I'm like, well, I called her earlier today, so there'll be nothing new to say to her. And I should probably save all of my goss for, like, in a few days.
I just had COVID, guys. So Maya and I were FaceTiming a lot because I actually needed the emotional support. So it's very lonely being in quarantine.
It really sucks being in quarantine. This is an insane week in general. Hannah had COVID. You guys are going to be getting this late, but Trump got fucking shot, which was insane. And it's always insane to be in the U.S. when that happens. People are saying it was staged. I haven't. My friends in one of my group chats, I think I'm like their political correspondent or something, because one of them was like, Maya, do you think it was staged? Like, they tagged me. And I was like, oh, I don't mean.
That's so funny. When it happened, I think someone had mentioned it in our group chat. I've been just like out of the world. Like, I was quarantining, staying out of the loop, and someone mentioned it in our group chat, and I was like, you know what, it's bedtime, gonna put the phone away, I'll read about this later.
Let's shut the world off. People keep coming up with articles being like, finding out the motive behind this guy who shot Trump, and it's like, well, yeah, we'd probably know his fucking motive if he didn't blow him to smithereens like 0.5 seconds after all that happened. So I'm curious to find out. The only thing is, he's dead, so no one will really get the full answer, probably.
It's also, like, it doesn't sound like he's part of some, like, grand organized scheme. He's sounded like a 21-year-old child. I don't know.
Yeah, 20, I think, even, which is really wild. I mean, I totally understand why Americans are buying into these conspiracies, because, like, I wouldn't trust anything either, but who knows? Too early to tell everyone. Well, maybe when this episode comes out, we'll find out whether or not
we'll have to be like, actually, guys, update, just like we did with Love Island, an equally important news event.
Because I was hyping up UK, but like, actually, little do people know, I've actually been watching US like in the weeks since then, and I completely jumped ship on UK, and US did indeed deliver.
Yeah, I'm actually devastated it's about to end. It carried me through. It's carried me through a rough time. I actually have never cried at a reality show until this current season of US. I don't cry at reality TV. You're shocked.
I think I cry when people are getting bullied. I think I've cried during those.
Yeah, moments. You have. Well, no, you have very strong emotional reactions to reality TV. I did not think that Love Island US could elicit emotion from me like that. And boy, have I cried on multiple occasions watching it. Some of it is projection, but it's really gotten me through some stuff, or like at least been a good cathartic outlet.
Yeah, we're in our feels these days. I was crying in the cafe yesterday writing my own video script, crying on that multiple points of the day. So, you know,
as one does.
We're all here shedding tears, apparently. RIP Shelley Duvall, my beautiful, lanky princess. I am so sad.
I know, and RIP Shannon Doherty.
And R.I.P. Shannon Doherty, who is also a princess, and
also
both
yeah.
very devastating and sad. Two queens gone too soon. And on that wonderful note,
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is on when art met the internet. Is the sun rising on a new creative era, or did it set before it even began? If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have monthly bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us a lot. This episode's going to be a little bit different because rather than like tell a story explicitly about the internet, we're going to talk about like one specific piece of media, which you do a lot, of course, on your YouTube. But I'm also a film girly, so I'm excited to kind of have my own little platform to talk about a movie. And that movie is Party Girl. So nearly 30 years ago, on June 3rd, 1995, a historic event occurred. A film premiered on the internet for the first time. And the film was a low-budget indie made for and by the girls and the gays, set in New York City's club scene, called Party Girl. Preceding the streaming era by decades, Party Girl is both ahead of its time and a snapshot of a bygone era. Though it is by no means responsible for the streaming boom, its journey from box office flop to cult classic is tightly linked to the technological evolution that has taken place over these past three decades. And I also want to give the biggest shout out to our friend Mojan, who has been insisting that I watch Party Girl for ages, and then finally like sat me down and made me watch it. And she was right. It was a perfect film for me.
Also, I sat on my glasses yesterday, so this is what they look like now.
Yeah, they're slightly ajar.
Lopsided. No, they're extremely ajar. And then the worst person in the U.S., so I have to wear these in public and I can't get them fixed because...
No. Why? I'm sure, like, you could just get it repaired. I don't think it would be, like, expensive.
I'm a little bit like, get me some new glasses, so I'm just going to wait it out and look like a kook.
No, you just kind of look quirky, like you're a disheveled protagonist.
Miss Frazzle? What's her name?
Miss Frizzle? She doesn't have glasses. Are you talking about the Magic School Bus?
The teacher in High School Musical? That could be her. Anyways, I'm serving cunt right now with my askew glasses.
Yeah, you're serving drama teacher cunt.
Drama teacher realness. Okay, proceed.
I'm going to give like a quick synopsis of the film, but I highly encourage you guys to pause this and go watch it if you haven't already. But Party Girl tells the story of Mary, a 23-year-old party girl and orphan who is arrested at the start of the film for throwing illegal parties in her New York City loft. And in order to pay off her bail, Mary begins working for her godmother as a clerk at the public library, and she finds herself juggling two worlds. And then when her love interest, a falafel cart vendor named Mustafa, tells her about the myth of Sisyphus, she has an existential crisis and seeks out a life's purpose. Does that seem like a good synopsis?
Yeah, I think you covered all your bases.
Thank you.
Such a funny premise.
It is constantly criticized for having such like a thin and flimsy premise, but I think it's so great and so original and silly.
I also don't even think it's thin and flimsy. It's like a bit of a coming of age or like lost in your 20s movie.
Totally.
I think it's fine. It's cohesive. She has an arc.
I think they were just like, it is a stretch to have her put in this specific circumstance, but I'm a fan.
The myth of Sisyphus?
Oh, the myth of Sisyphus? Okay, that, not to get into it, but I was like watching that movie and I read The Myth of Sisyphus around that age and like it, I was like, wow. I've unlocked the universe and like I understand things and things feel right. And like it really did help with my quarter life crisis. So seeing a movie where the myth of Sisyphus plays a big role in someone's quarter life crisis was extremely specifically resonant with me.
Wasn't there like a meme going around that's like, if your girl reads this, walk away or something? Or it was like some sort of like meme roasting a certain type of girl who drinks like matcha lattes and the myth of Sisyphus. And I'm like, okay, sorry that women are educated. Like,
oh, I think it was bizarre. Yeah, a photo of like a black coffee and a copy of the myth of Sisyphus, and then that's someone so else had like saved it and was like the worst person ever. And I was like, that is me. That's literally me. If a woman shows interest in anything, it's like, and this is an indicator that she sucks.
Well,
and I don't even know
any of those niche meme accounts, like, it, no one's safe, it feels like. It's just like, okay, everyone is cringe, cool. Like, after a while, you're like, okay.
Well, it just shows someone trying to show how specific their knowledge base is by being like, oh, wow, if your girl reads this kind of philosophy, ugh. But it's a good read.
I was in my phone yesterday and she really went like on a really long rant about Jacques Lacan, and I was like, this is so hot of you. She was like telling me about the schools of psychoanalysis and the ones that she prefers, and I was like, the fact that you even like have developed enough of an interest and passion in psychoanalysis to like pick a school of thought that you personally prefer is hot.
Yeah, it's cool to know things. And like, yes, The Myth of Sisyphus is the only actual philosophy book I've read the entirety of. But I've been exposed to other philosophies, and this is the one that spoke to me. We watched the film together, and I had forbidden you from reading into it before we recorded. But now, before I, like, go into the kind of history and the making of, I want to get your takes. Like, what are some of the elements or themes that stuck out to you? Like, what resonated?
I think I really liked that it depicted such a niche subculture that I feel like wasn't depicted. I mean, it is an indie film, but it wasn't depicted really in like mainstream films. And because it had Parker Posey, it did kind of have this like indie star power to it that I think brings attention to those subcultures without being either condescending about them or like voyeuristic of them. Like, it felt like just that they just exist within the film. Parker Posey is just such a little freak, and I love her so much. Everything she's in, she's the only person who could do the thing she's doing. And I could not put a finger on what exactly her persona is, but I think it's just freak. She's on freak mode at all times.
Well, people really talk about this movie as being like the Parker Posey of Parker Posey roles. Like, it is her at her peak. They really modeled the character after screwball comedies of like the 30s and the 40s, because like you can really see that. And she has, like, I watched Bringing Up Baby, and not only does she look like Katharine Hepburn, but they're doing the same thing.
They have the same crazy kind of like physicality and bizarre comedic timing. Like, the comedic timing that you could never describe or anticipate.
And it just feels so natural, and like it's such an offbeat charm.
I watched, and I can't shut the fuck up about it, but I watched Nashville by Robert Altman last week, and there's a woman in it who looks exactly like Parker Posey, who's like playing this BBC correspondent, and oh my god, I just felt like she was such an interesting predecessor to Parker Posey, who also happened to look like her. But yeah, just having this like intractable kind of like comedic edge, I don't know. So yeah, I think I love that. Obviously, she is the movie. I love the costuming. It's so 90s, but also really like absurd and surreal in such a fun way. I love her love interest, Mustafa. One, he's sexy, but two, I just love how cute it is that she falls in love with her falafel vendor, because like, yeah, sexy man, and he's making you falafel. So I love
that. Yeah, what more could you ask for?
Yeah, and I also just like the arc. I like that she works at this library that her, I believe it's like her godmother or one of her like mother's good friends who she hasn't really like connected with is running the library, and then Parker Posey she gets the job as like a survival job, but ends up actually finding a lot of joy and purpose in it, and like seeing it a bit as like an art form, which I think is just so beautiful, and it's so cute. She gets so into the Dewey Decimal System, and she becomes good at her job. And I don't know, I just think it's a really low stakes, like small scale film in such a comforting way, and that's something I really enjoyed about it.
It's like the stakes are all so personal, but they still are entertaining. Like, it's the opposite of like a mumblecore film, but it has the same kind of arc that you might see in like a Frances Ha or something, where she's lost, she's in her 20s, and she's sort of like floating through different casts of characters. But it's just, yeah, it's everything is just turned up in a way because their influences are these kind of heightened comedies of the past. Even like setting it in the library was beckoning back to that time. And it's like, it's very interesting. I agree completely. I think it's comforting, but it also like kind of transports you a bit. Like it gets you a little excited to watch, which is kind of special.
It's such a movie that you watch with your friends sitting around the TV.
Well, yeah, it should be like a slumber party canon film. And I think it's insane that it didn't end up that way.
It's just a little too weird, to be honest.
Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps. It's a bit more like adult.
The wrong way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked what you were saying about how it doesn't feel voyeuristic or anything about the community and like the subculture. And I think a big part of that is because the people who made the film were actually a part of that group. Like they were representing worlds that they were mixing with or like a part of. So the film is the brainchild of co-writers Daisy von Schurlermeyer and Harry Birkmeyer. And von Schurlermeyer also directed the film with Birkmeyer serving as producer. And Daisy von Schurlermeyer, I think her parents were in the film industry. Her mom plays Mary's godmother in the film. And she was sneaking out to go to Studio 54 as a teenager. Like she was fully going out from a young age. And that's actually where the two of them met for the second time. And Birkmeyer, who was a bit older, he did cocaine for the first time with a teenage Daisy von Schurlermeyer at Studio 54.
That's sick as fuck.
On like a Tuesday or something. Yeah.
No, but of course.
I think her best friend was Sydney Lumet's daughter. So like they had the in, but it's just so funny. So like they were very aware of like the downtown scene. She was renting out her loft to do plays out of, kind of like how Mary would throw parties out of her loft. And then their music supervisor, Bill Coleman, had been DJing in New York since he was like a teen, I think. And he was also responsible basically for discovering D-Light. He's even in the Groove is in the Heart music video. Yeah, he went on to manage them because he was working for a Billboard and he kind of pushed them forward or something. He got sent their single and then he became their manager, which is crazy. And then their costume designer, Michael Clancy, had worked as a doorman at the club Area, which was like a very like kind of cloudy, cool club. And then Parker Posey herself was living in New York and she was kind of hanging around the drag scene and going to see like RuPaul and Lady Bunny at Club Love. Like she was immersed in that. So they were all really connected to the actual scene that they were depicting,
like,
which
so many creative scenes in most like major cities are so nebulous in so many ways. Like everyone's just connected to everyone, has worked on some project with someone, has collaborated with someone here, has gone to this club with this person. Like it's just so molecular. Is that the right word?
I don't know if molecular is the right word, but I get what you're saying.
I'm gonna
yeah.
run with whatever that word
yeah,
is.
Yeah, coin it.
Feels molecular.
But yeah, what you're saying about it being kind of a nebulous scene or a, like interconnected, I do agree. I think, I mean, New York specifically, I think a lot of people living in New York in creative fields at that age have parents who are connected and have grown up together. You know, I think things are networked in a way that like people kind of naturally fall into. So I think it's easier to kind of meet the right people perhaps in those worlds. But then yeah, I don't know. It is kind of interesting to like think about how the nightlife was overlapping with the creative worlds because, you know, like everyone we know, these people are often working two jobs. Like you're pursuing your creative field, but you're also doing this. Like Harry Birkmeyer, he was teaching ESL at one point, and that's where he kind of decided when they were making the love interest to be, you know, from Lebanon and to be like not a native English speaker. When they were casting, they're like, we need to cast a Middle Eastern actor. We need to like have it authentic to this. And he was sort of like based off of his experience of teaching ESL in New York.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think it's just interesting to think about people's lives overlapping in these different ways. And they also intentionally wanted to write the script like it was a documentary. They interview DJs and librarians, and there's a whole kind of speech about how Melville Dewey, who invented the Dewey Decimal System, was sexist and sort of his ideas about like women's work. And that came from interviewing a librarian who was like, no, we hate Melville Dewey because he was like a misogynist. they were like, we didn't want to write a script the way you would maybe learn to in school. And you can kind of tell, like, the movie gets a little random.
It's a little bit vignette-y. Like, you have these, like, strange vignettes. There's this one sequence that's so jarring where her roommate, who's a DJ, is, like, showering in the shower. And
yeah,
Burger Posey's like, let me into the bathroom. And he's like, no. And she's like, come on. So she bursts into the bathroom, takes off her clothes, and gets in the shower with him. And then they start, like, kissing. And then it just, the movie just never addresses it again.
No.
They're, like, making out naked in the shower.
They stop kissing. She goes, incest. And then it's, like, never addressed again.
Never addressed again, which I loved.
Yeah, it gets a little kind of kooky like that. They did not adhere to a structure. But I think that in reviews from the time, like, I think some people were really critical of the script. They found it annoying. They found a lot of the, like, slang and stuff that they were using to be too much. But I think that in retrospect, it kind of all works. It all does feel natural, at least to the characters and to, like, where they are.
It feels natural, but it feels like a pretty cohesive tone, and the tone is that it's absurd, which I think, like, is pretty in keeping with the myth of Sisyphus and, like, the absurdity of life, you know? So it's well, like, that's how I read it completely. Like, it's an absurd movie. It's a bit absurdist, but not fully, because obviously it follows, like, it still follows a cohesive narrative structure. So it's, like, it's not even a fully an absurdist movie, but it has an absurd tone to it that I think all Parker Posey movies and characters do, but this one specifically.
Certainly. She's an absurdist figure herself, you might say. Also, going back to the kind of documentary of it, a fun fact is that Harry Birkmeyer was actually a PA on Paris is Burning, which I think also perhaps doesn't, like, directly inform the film, but that was his background in the industry, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, I was thinking about where ball and club culture would ever be seen. Not that there, I don't think there is a ball in Party Girl, but, like, you do kind of get this, like, club kid kind
Well, there's
of
voguing and stuff.
Culture, there's voguing, and, like, I was like, where else did people see that in the 90s? And I was like, oh, well, Paris is Burning. So that's really interesting that those two things happen to be connected.
Well, and also, like, what I'll say is that, like, this is a post-Vogue, like, Madonna's Vogue world, right? So voguing isn't, like, so obscure, and, like, the club kids of the time, like, they were making basically, like, yearly appearances on Geraldo and other kind of daytime talk shows. Like, people knew of them, like, they weren't so underground, and, like, RuPaul had, like, blown up and stuff, so it was like,
well, that's what, like, Paris is Burning tracks is kind of like the mainstream like dilution of ball culture. So yeah, of course that makes sense.
And Paris is Burning and Party Girl do also feel like some of the very few actual pieces of media depicting it, though, that, like, I know of.
That at least are, like, well-known enough to be talked about by these two bitches.
Yeah. And so the film is, like, truly an indie. It was made with a $150,000 budget. And, like,
I was so
shot
excited
on
for you to say $150.
Oh, my God. I mean, that would be epic. That would be iconic. No, but, like, $150,000 in the film industry may as well be, like, a $150 budget.
Yeah, that's pennies.
Especially, like, this is the 90s. They're shooting everything on film. They really couldn't afford film. So if you watch the film a second time, you'll see shots that are out of focus. And it's clear that they just couldn't be picky. They're like, okay, we got the dialogue. We got to use it.
Because it happens with film a lot, which is interesting. Like, shooting on film, I think that often it can be out of focus. I'm not going to, like, say any specifics, but I have a friend whose best friend is, like, a cinematographer who's, like, working in the industry and, like, pretty prolific. And the movie that this person most recently shot, they shot on film, and 50% of the movie is out of focus.
It's so expensive to shoot on film. Yeah.
So expensive, so tedious.
Exactly. So it's interesting to, like, when you can tell that something's low budget, or you know going into it, and then you watch it and you can kind of see it. But, like, in this case, it really lends to the charm. Like, Mary's wardrobe, which is sort of one of the most iconic parts of the film at this point, it's what gets talked about still. Articles are always written about how it's a fashion film. That wardrobe was, you know, made up of, like, Parker Posey's wardrobe and Daisy Von Schirler's wardrobe, and then, like, pieces they could sort of pull. But she repeats a lot of outfits, which is fun, or, like, she'll rewear certain articles of clothing, which I always love. I love when people rewear things in films and television, because it just feels so much more lived in.
Of course, yeah, and we're supposed to understand that she's broke as fuck.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see she has her, like, go-to pieces, and her clothes are very non-male gaze, too. Like, she wears, like,
They're quirky.
Truly some of the strangest clothing, and it's so cute and fun.
Yeah, she'll wear like platform sneaker heels and then different colored pantyhose. I love it. And Parker Posey, actually, one of the reasons she got the role was that she was like, I have 80 pairs of shoes. Like, I am Mary. You have to give me this role, which I appreciate. And she, okay, so she made about like $70 a day doing the film. And they even had to like beg for money to buy film for like their Polaroid so they could take continuity shots. Like, it's a low budge film for sure.
Wow. That's incredible.
And so after they finish the film and they're shopping it around to bigger distributors, they're not really getting the bites that they want. But eventually it gets picked up by an independent company called First Look Features. And it premieres on the big screen at the Seattle International Film Festival while simultaneously online on a video meeting software called See You, See Me. So in 1995, one of the sponsors of the Seattle International Film Festival was a company called Silicone Graphics, who had the ability to live stream a film. And so wanting publicity for the project, the Party Girl team, with the help of the Point of Presence company, took up that opportunity. And on June 3rd, 1995, Parker Posey went to the Point of Presence company's offices and introduced the film before its premiere. And NBC did like a piece about it, so I'm going to show it to you. I sent it to you because I just want you to get a sense of what the graphics looked like.
Ah, I love. Okay.
Do you want to describe the quality of the stream itself?
The stream is pixely for sure. The website that it's on is like this gray website with those like big chunky windows. And you have like a little picture of Parker Posey, like a little cutout and like the movie title and stuff. But it's very lo-fi.
Well, it's black and white and it's like moving at like a couple frames a minute. Like it's not seamlessly playing. It's, yeah, definitely pixelated. Definitely not the quality that we've become accustomed to with streaming.
But I guess it's like, yeah, the novelty. Like, back then, it's just what we were willing. I mean, okay, not back then for me and you. Like, not the mid-90s. But, you know, even back in the day when we were growing up, like, what we were willing to put up with and, like, the patience that we had for the internet was just completely different. It's so interesting, like, seeing my nieces get mad about their like, not to be such an old man yells at cloud, but like just seeing my nieces get so mad at their iPads when it's like at half a second delay. Whereas like, I remember trying to show my little cousin the video of Michael, this is like after Michael Jackson died, but I was trying to show her the video of Michael Jackson doing the moonwalk at the Motown Awards in like 1983. And I remember sitting there with her for 1.5 hours as the video would just buffer and buffer and buffer and buffer. But I was like, you need to watch the whole thing.
Yeah. You had to dedicate like a significant amount of time to watch a video that was a few minutes long. And you were like, this is okay. We get to watch a video. Yeah.
And just even putting up with the little rainbow wheel. Whenever the little rainbow wheel comes up on my computer these days, I'm like, oh my God, we're about to crash. Whereas like back in the day, it's like anytime you double clicked on anything, it would be like little rainbow wheel.
As a PC kid growing up, we had the like the little hourglass.
Sorry, that's I had PCs too. Yeah, the hourglass. I can't even remember anymore.
Ominous. God, how times have flown by. Flying by? Flown by?
How times have flown by. Honestly, I'm not that sounded Shakespearean.
Wow. Thou time shallest flying by.
I'm sorry, what?
Never mind. Moving on.
Thout? Hannah's on full glitch mode today. She's look, buffering.
I drank a very large coffee.
Hey, you should start drinking Celsius, Hannah. I'd be really curious because I can't Celsius? Drink it, but I want to know what you think. It's like a super caffeinated drink, but people love it, and I really want to know what you think. Or like yerba mate. Come on, Hannah.
No,
please.
I really shouldn't be drinking like caffeine at all, to be honest.
No, I can't do it myself. I need you to do this for me.
I think you need to grow up and deal with it.
Hannah and I are wearing identical dresses today. Identical.
And they're like our.
Can I take a screenshot?
Yeah.
Hey, they are like our camera. Look sexy, Hannah.
Oh wow, they're gonna love this.
This is really a yapping episode.
This is what happens. This is our FaceTime. This is half FaceTime, half episode. But it's okay. I think that they're going to love it. We're all going to love it. So the live broadcast was watched by only a few hundred people. Household computers with internet were not very commonplace. Harry Brookmeyer himself had to go watch it at a friend's house on their computer because he didn't own one. And because the quality of the stream was so bad, like we described, Party Girls distributor told NBC that they couldn't see online streaming as any real threat to the cinemas. Ominous last words. But the publicity stunt of premiering online was not as effective as the Party Girl team may have hoped for. It was a box office flop a little, only grossing $472,000. And the reviews were like nice enough. Many praised Parker Posey's performance, and this was her first leading role, and it did cement her as the sort of indie screen queen of the 90s.
Does 400k on a 100k budget count as a flop? Or I guess that's not including the marketing budget.
I guess you're calling me out. Okay, maybe not a flop. It wasn't a hit. Let's just say that. But like, still, as Harry Brookmeyer put it, you know, he said, over the years, I've encountered a sweet cult following whose members often include gay people, librarians, designer, creative types, and of course, party people. And I do think that Party Girl at least found some of its audience for people. But it is crazy to think that, you know, when it was utilizing this new video streaming technology, what is now sort of the norm for film and television, they were doing it in this DIY spirit. To quote Daisy von Schirler-Meyer, she said, I think it goes with a lot of the spirit around the film, which was a really positive, celebratory little engine that could. And that's such a funny way to think about the internet.
This also just makes me think a lot about, like, when a movie or, like, a piece of media is coming out in real time. This is just like, it goes back to the concept of like a cult movie, but how you'd receive it, because I think a lot of the way we look at Parker Posey now and we look at this specific movie is that we're like, how quaint, how interesting, what a historical artifact, you know, how strange. But like, if we were this age back then, I'm really curious to know what we would have thought of that movie, you know what I mean? Because like, when it's happening in the, when it's contemporarily watched, it's like, would we be as interested in it? I don't know.
No, I think about that a lot with certain movies where I'm like, I actually think that this movie would be a movie that it'd be embarrassing to like now, but in retrospect, people are going to be like, wow, this was kind of fun and I missed it.
What movie?
This is kind of embarrassing. There's this, that Netflix movie, Do Revenge. I watched it and I was like, it's very much like a pastiche of the 90s teen movie. But after watching like the terrible Mean Girls reboot, I was like, Do Revenge is actually like mean and biting and actually kind of witty about shit going on. And it felt very aware of the times it was being made in. And it felt like it was being made by people who understood. But I think it was a Netflix movie starring people from Riverdale. And I don't think it became a movie that people talked about. I do think that
Hannah rides hard for Camila Mendes.
I do. I love the woman of Riverdale. But I think that in like 10 years or 15 years, teens are going to watch it and be like, oh, this was actually like a good movie that fell under the radar. I don't know if people our age are going to like reclaim it. It's not for us, but I think that
It's just what's happening with teens now.
Retroactively, yeah. And then Jennifer's Body is like a classic example of that.
Oh, such a good point. Where it's like, it's just not working for the present moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Even people reclaiming Twilight in a way that takes it way more seriously than it was like ever taken.
To be totally.
But first, I kind of wanted to talk about streaming a bit more in a general sense, because this all made me think about the controversy that went down between Cannes and Netflix back in 2017. Basically, France has laws about the time that can pass between a film's theatrical release and its streaming release. So right now it's 15 to 17 months, but back in 2017, it was 36 months, which is 3 years. And this is when Netflix was first starting to get into like the prestige film world. So they wanted to premiere films in France at Cannes, but then like immediately have them go up on Netflix like they were going to do with the rest of the world. But in order to have their films premiere on Netflix with the rest of the world, it meant they couldn't do an actual theatrical run in France because they'd have to then wait 3 years. And this really pissed off French theater owners. And so then in retaliation, Cannes imposed a rule which made it so any film that wished to compete in any of the festival's main competitions must have a French theatrical release. So then the following year, Netflix chose not to have any films play in the festival at all, because they're like, okay, we're not gonna like abide by that. And it was sort of like a standoff. It kind of set in motion like the first really big debate about streaming versus theaters and like how seriously we should take this kind of newer space, which is like Netflix and Amazon, like having their own prestige films. And I'm curious, I feel like I know what your takes are going to be, but like, where do you lie in this conversation?
Very firmly in the realm of fuck streaming.
Yeah.
Very firmly in the realm of fuck streaming. I think over the past few years, you know, the more I've come to just think about, I've talked about this like extensively on my channel, but streaming has eroded like a lot of aspects of filmmaking and like the profitability of filmmaking over the years. Like what we are seeing with the actors and the writer strike is that like it's collapsed royalties. So like actors and writers used to make significantly more money off of what they were doing with shows as opposed to now where they get paid pennies with streaming. I think it's something that's really important to a lot of filmmakers to be able to have your movie be seen on a big screen. And now these days, a lot of movies are just going straight to streaming. So like a lot of filmmakers are robbed of that opportunity. The list is like actually fucking endless. Yeah. But as I've been kind of talking about over the past few months, I also think that like the theater going experience and the communal experience of watching a movie for the first time is becoming way more important to me now. I think Same. With May December, that really became clear to me, like after I got ratioed on Twitter for saying May December was a comedy and people were like, how could you ever think a movie like that's a comedy? And I was like, well, I saw it in the theater and everyone was laughing and like yeah. picking up on these really subtle, numerous comedic elements that were integrated into the movie that someone watching it at home distracted or just like on a smaller screen might miss alone, like, you know, not feeding off the energy of the people around them. It's really like actually killed filmmaking. It's made it really hard for certain projects to be greenlit. Mid-budget or like low-budget projects almost never make it off the ground anymore. It's why we're seeing the prevalence of like Marvel movies, for example, or like IP-driven movies becoming these like blockbuster sensations, whereas like any original movie isn't, in the way that like growing up you'd go to the theater and you'd see any kind of movie in the theater. So yeah, that's my take on it. I am very anti-streaming these days. I'm a purist.
I think it's just a matter of like, okay, we accept the fact that things are going to be primarily consumed on streaming platforms. Like, that's how most people consume those things. But I don't think that that's a reason to forego the whole idea of like a theatrical release. I think that it's not a reason to not like maintain that as a practice, like culturally. I think that you just get something from being in a theater that you simply can't get from being at home. And I think part of it is like the immersive element to it, and part of it is the energy of a crowd. It makes such a big difference. Even when I saw Challengers, I was shocked to see how full it was, and it was so exciting. It was like half price movie day and it was full of like young women mostly there to see it, and everybody was excited and like there was a certain energy to it, and I was like, fuck, I feel like I'm seeing a Marvel movie right now. Like the way that people are so anticipatory, the way they're excited, and like not every movie has to be seen with that level of energy and enthusiasm, but it was kind of but it was special to be like reminded that people could show up like that for something that isn't like an IP film, for sure.
Well, also, it's like it makes that movie like a moment in your life. Like it makes the viewing of that movie a moment in your life that you'll remember. Whereas like I don't remember the specifics of any movie I watch at home, to be honest.
No.
And like I don't remember what I was doing. I don't remember what I was eating. Whereas like I will never forget being there for Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2 and the whole theater screaming like maniacs, including myself. You get caught up in this like hysteria that's, I think, beautiful, and it's so exciting, and it's good for the art. Even if you hate the movie, that's also cool. Like if everyone hates the movie and they're like boo, you know, it's great. It's great. It's a great way to consume art. I think it's how films should be consumed. And yeah, I'm a little bit like fuck nuance with this. I don't really care. I don't feel like being nuanced about streaming.
Like, no, and I just, you know, theater feels like so much like the underdog now that it's just kind of like I'm okay to go hard for them, you know?
We ride at dawn.
We ride at dawn for cinema. But yeah, I'm personally trying to get back into seeing more movies in the theaters. And a lot of the films that like I'll go see here in Toronto aren't necessarily new releases either, because we have a lot of smaller theaters that have really good programming.
Scratch that. We have like two smaller theaters, just to be clear. To yes. go back to the idea of streaming killing theaters, Toronto has about two theaters left that are
is true.
Able to small, to be clear. But that is, yes, I agree.
Yeah. A lot of is not the right word. But we have theaters, yeah. smaller independent theaters that are really great spaces to watch films that, you know, you might have missed the first time they were released because you weren't born yet, you know. Local theaters will play like older films, but there's like also a lot of really good programming with sort of cult films. I recently saw Showgirls, for example, at our local theater, The Review, and it's the type of movie that, like you're saying, like you want to watch with an audience because people are laughing at the same kind of campy, absurd moments in the film together. And it's kind of, I think in a way, almost like cues to you. This is funny.
Yeah, totally.
We're laughing together, you know?
Yeah.
And like on the subject of cult films, I think cult status is like sort of like a precarious title to like give something. It's not always like clear what makes a cult film. There is a 1981 book called Cult Movies by Danny Peary, and that's sort of considered like the text to refer to. And for him, he lists these attributes. He says, atypical heroes and heroines, offbeat dialogue, surprising plot resolutions, highly original storylines, brave themes, often of a sexual or political nature, definitive performances by stars who have cult status, or the novel handling of popular but still genres. And I'd say like by those
metrics,
thank you. Would you say that Party Girl qualifies as a cult film?
Definitely. I mean, like I've been writing about cult film for a forthcoming project. And like a lot of the time, there's kind of this divide in scholarship on cult film about whether or not a cult film means that it has to be like a film that's a B movie or indie movie that's like redeemed by an audience. Or, like, celebrated by an audience but not by the mainstream or, like, reviled by the mainstream. And then a movie that actually is big budget or, like, considerable budget but then doesn't do as well as people think it will and then is a bit of, like, a sleeper hit. And I think Party Girl kind of falls into the former. Like, I think it's definitely kind of, like, a smaller scale, quirky, independent, low-budget movie that simultaneously also didn't do well when it came out but is slowly redeemed and also found itself a niche audience that loves it and like yeah loves its heroine.
Yeah, and I think just like even the qualities of having yes an atypical heroine, the dialogue is certainly offbeat, the plot resolutions are insane, there's a definitive performance by a star with cult status like Parker Posey, I would say is certainly has her own cult status. But I think it's a little ironic that Party Girl is a cult film because of its relationship with the internet. I read this really interesting piece by Judy Berman for The Baffler, where she dissects the cult film in the streaming era. And she says that the internet has basically become like the main meeting place of cultist film fans rather than the cinema at this point. And that, you know, while it has made these films more accessible, it also, quote, imperils the physical spaces where cult films and the people who love them can forge communities with real-world agencies. And then she points to the successes of films like The Room as having started a trend of intentionally bad movies like Birdemic or Sharknado, which like aren't political or transgressive or offbeat in like a sincere nature, but they're just part of what she calls the economy of public humiliation. And then says that like films with genuine cult potential are getting lost in the streaming void, buried amongst so many other films. Because like if you're on Netflix, you're going to see the films you recognize. And then you're going to see a bunch of like random, like low budget titles that kind of are way lower down the list and you'll probably never click on. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of the cult films or potential cult films go to die.
In the sea of lost movies, the sea of misfit movies.
Sea of misfit movies.
The island of misfit movies.
Aw, yeah. And I think that there's something funny about that because the internet, yes, makes cult properties a bit more accessible, but it also, like, makes them harder to even be aware of or to, like, become cult. Yeah, they're just...
And because so much of a cult movie is the kind of, like, yeah, that Rocky Horror kind of physical experience with it, like I was saying about the different kind of camps of cult scholarship, like, so much of that is lost with the internet.
So... Party Girl may have had like a minor premiere online, but like funnily enough, it was impossible to find on the internet until about a year ago. So for the 25 plus years before then, it was the people who had seen it in theaters and rented it from the video store that did keep the film's flame alive. So When Party Girl's original distributors went out of business, it went out of print completely. And ironically, it wasn't on any streamers. Considering its history, that's kind of funny. And, like, it was a film that I'd been kind of recommended before or, like, seen on websites, like, from cool people, talked about, but it was never on anything. So it, like, never came to my attention to watch it. That's until boutique distributor Fun City Editions released a 4K restoration of the film in 2023, which they released on Blu-ray. And then it ended up being re-released into theaters to celebrate the restoration and is now housed on the Criterion Channel under the Parker Posey Collection, which is how our friend Mojan came to watch it and how I came to watch it through her suggestion.
If there's anyone doing the internet right, it's Criterion for sure. Like the way that they market themselves and like just following their Instagram, yeah, gets you so invested in these films that you wouldn't necessarily think about. Same with Mubi. Yeah, I've really been enjoying following Criterion.
Yeah. It's such an array of the films that they host on there too. You do appreciate because it does. There's stuff that you think might get written off by like something that's like high culture like that. But I think that they take like a very interesting consideration to like all kinds of films. And this does all kind of feel like the appropriate journey for Party Girl to have undergone. Do you agree?
Oh yeah, totally. I don't think it's a movie that was made to be consumed by the masses or like immediately loved or anything like that. Like it's a weird, silly little movie. It's kind of pushing you away a little bit, like, or it's weeding out its audience a little bit, seeing who can stand the test of the movie. And I think some movies are meant to be kind of niche and to be reclaimed and to be found by other generations who are also niche. And I think it's the perfect little gem, you know?
Diamond in the Rust. No, I agree. I would say it's almost like a time capsule. Right? Because I think it really did capture the essence of a time and place and then was sort of like lost to time for many years and is now being discovered at a time where people are interested in the world and the culture that it's depicting more than ever before.
You could say we're film archaeologists and we're excavating this lost treasure.
Well, yes. I think it's nice to be like, oh, I haven't seen all of these types of films. There's a type of offbeat, like, 90s film that I grew up watching and that I have a lot of love for, but it's kind of nice to be like, oh, I missed this one, and now I get to see it for the first time at this age.
If there's one thing about 90s cinema, there's a lot of it.
There is. They made many movies back then.
Weird movies? Abundant.
And I think it's also interesting to kind of think about it also as a film that has this connection to the internet, but is like so cemented in a pre-digital era. Mary's roommate Leo is a DJ and he's got crates full of thousands of records, like physical records. Nowadays, you know, vinyl DJs are more of like a novelty thing for bars that want to like oversell you on like entrance fees, but they're not they're not really like common. And then, you know, Mary's arc is really represented through her grasp of the Dewey Decimal System and her ability to kind of give people these really personalized recommendations of the books in the library, which now people don't really turn to librarians for that. They turn to Google or even ChatGPT at this point to like do the research or the preliminary research for them.
In one scene, she rearranges her roommate's records into like a Dewey Decimal System. And he's like, what the fuck? I had a system going. And she's like, no. And it's just like the physical process of doing that. And like the fact that it took him time to kind of arrange all of that is, fascinating. Yeah.
Well, and like just the physical tokens of what you're doing, which we just don't have anymore. Everything is so like non-material, you know?
Yeah.
So like it feels very cemented in its time, but then I think it's constantly now being praised as being ahead of its time because of the diversity of the film. You know, it's a much more honest depiction of New York City than you would see in a lot of 90s media. Like, if you think about this being made at the same time as, like, Friends or something, you know, Friends gets criticized a lot for its lack of diversity. In Party Girl, they basically were like, we want to make a film that stars all the people that would have, like, very small parts in other films. And so the world around Mary, like, is very queer. It's very black and brown, and it's authentic to the world that the filmmakers were living in. They kind of are always like, no, we're not ahead of our times. Like, don't talk about the film like that because it was just honest to us.
That was happening, but, yeah.
Yeah, but still, like, even if they're like, oh, we don't want that praise, I think it does feel very refreshing when you compare it to other works from the same time.
Well, it's not ahead of its time in that, like, the things and the people it's depicting are of that time, but it's just ahead of its time in the way that it actually chooses to film and, like, put the camera on those people and things.
Yeah. But, like you were saying earlier about, like, the film not feeling voyeuristic and feeling, like, authentic, that was something it was praised for at the time. If you, like, watch the film, you'll see cameos from club scene staples like Lady Bunny, the It Twins, which are those two green-haired guys, Natasha Twist, who in the kind of an iconic moment in the film, Parker Posey is like, Natasha! And then she kind of gets moved around. Yeah. And they're all like real people from like the nightlife scene. And they never kind of feel like set dressing. They're kind of just like seamlessly like integrated into the nightclub scenes.
So do you think if Party Girl was made now, you'd see the DaVinci twins in it or what?
Could you imagine? Well, okay. And I know we're joking.
Couple night out in New York, see the DaVinci twins.
DaVinci, you're going to get vogued around by the DaVinci twins. Talking about like present readings of Party Girl, we've been talking and like joking throughout the season about Brat Summer. And this wasn't even like an on-purpose connection, but while I was reading Letterboxd reviews for Party Girl, I learned that Charlie XCX had programmed it as part of a series at the Roxy Theater of films that had inspired Brat. And immediately, like, I started doing Galaxy Brain, and I was like, oh, yes, like, the parallels are there. They're basically both, like, these euphoric celebrations of clubbing culture and, you know, the downtown it girl and scene. But they're also these, like, existential reflections on the sustainability of that lifestyle. And just some, like, parallels to songs between, like, the film and the movie. Mary is kind of, like, the prototype for the character that Charlie sings about on the song Mean Girls, which Megan Garvey from Pitchfork called the first major label pop song inspired by the Red Scare podcast. I mean, because she is this sort of edgelord, lower Manhattan scenester. She's not dissimilar to that crowd.
Is she an edgelord, though? Is she an edgelord? I can't
remember. I think the film has her being intentionally problematic. You know, there is a scene where it's supposed to show she's sort of at her worst, where she's using slurs and she's kind of thrown this like vaguely racist party for her Lebanese love interest. You know, the filmmakers insist that like that was to show like Mary's in the wrong, like Mary was messing up. But I would say, yeah, I would say she's edgelord adjacent. And then like 360 and that music video, which stars people like Julia Fox and Rachel Sennett, Chloe Sevigny, sort of like an ode to the niche micro celebrities of our era. And it did make me think about the cameos from these niche micro celebrities of their scene that like show up throughout Party Girl. And then lastly, like there's this sort of more existential song towards the end of the album called I Think About It All the Time, where Charlie is wondering, you know, if it's worth it to move on from this stage of life. And she considers parenthood and thinks about like what that would mean for her. And it suggests that the album is going to end on a more thoughtful note before being cut off by the last song, 365, which is like, should we do a little key? Should we do a little line? I'm a party girl, whatever. And I think that like that kind of back and forth is where the DNA of Party Girl is so evident in Brat. When I watched Party Girl, at times I was like, oh my God, this is so much fun. It's making me want to go out. The music is so fun. Like, I love this. But then it also, I watched it around a particularly existential moment in my life, and it was really making me think and feel like deeper than I was anticipating from like a film that kind of gets written off for being frivolous.
Well, also, I guess we haven't really explained what the myth of Sisyphus is, but the myth of Sisyphus, for those who don't know, is that a man named Sisyphus pushes a rock or like a boulder up a mountain, and every time he gets to the top of the mountain, the boulder rolls back down and he starts over again, and it's supposed to like represent the like futility of life basically. And like the movie is, you know, while it's fun and while the language of it is kind of exciting and like immersive and whatnot, it is showing us the futility of her life as a party girl, like, you know, going out doing the same thing like every single night. And I think Brat is very much about that as well.
Well, yeah, and I think because Albert Camus says about the myth of Sisyphus is that we're supposed to imagine that Sisyphus is happy. We're supposed to imagine that because he knows that he's been damned to this task for the rest of eternity, and he has that knowledge, then he doesn't have to be in like despair over it. He can accept the absurdity of life. And so considering like perhaps a more existential moment that like we are all in collectively, I think that the pandemic sort of started. I think a lot of people are like embracing this more kind of acceptance of the absurd. I think that's why we're seeing trends lean more into like a fuck it kind of attitude, which is what also like Brat represents. More so than Party Girl, which I think in Myth of Sisyphus, he's like trying to find like an actual religious meaning to life is futile and that will only like make you unhappy. But I think that Party Girl still commits this idea of like finding a life's purpose. And I think Brat is a little bit more like, who fucking knows? I don't know. TBD, which felt a bit more in line with that. I guess I'm curious to know why you think that these works that have these themes are like hitting the way that they are right now.
Well, I think it's exactly what you said. Like, I think we're all in a place of like, the world is burning, let's dance, you know? We've always been talking about these kind of trends, like, you know, post-war periods and like thinking about Weimar Berlin, the 20s, post-World War I, and people partying and being hedonistic. And I think we are in a place of hedonism at the moment, because we were like actually physically like locked away for a few years. And I think that's exactly what's going on. We're a generation facing the precipice of maybe the fucking end of the world. So it's like, we're trying not to be doomers. And so we're like, okay, what else can we do? We may as well have fun while we can, you know? And I think that that's what the movie's about, while still giving you, yeah, like that balanced take on, you can have your fun, but also everyone needs to feel like there's some purpose.
There's like a sense of, you know, wanting something to live for on like an individual level while not tying it to like a greater, higher purpose is sort of part of all of this. And I think there's like a melancholy feeling that I got from watching the film where I was like, exciting, woo, but also, yeah, I don't know. I'm in my late 20s and I love going out with my friends, but also like I'm having a bit less fun doing it sometimes. I'm feeling more tired, but also I don't want to like give that up anytime soon either. So
yeah,
maybe if it's resonating particularly with our age group, but I do think, yeah, there's like also on a wider scale, like you're saying, it did make me think about the 1920s, did make me think about, you know, the clubbing scene coming out of Berlin. But then also I was thinking about it in like relation to the internet. Do you think the internet changes this a bit? Like, we're thinking about this kind of collective release of going, oh my God, things are terrible, things are stressful, the world is burning, let's go have fun. But then this album that supposedly represents that to a degree is also like so geared towards this kind of chronically online generation that it almost feels like we're taking the idea of like hedonism and then like selling it to people that are still attached to their screens. Does that make sense?
We're in a time right now where it's going to be impossible to get people completely off their screens. But I also think there's, in Toronto specifically, like so many events happening that are Brat oriented and Brat themed.
Yeah.
You see people going out to them. So I don't know. I don't necessarily want to say that like clubbing has necessarily died out or that like the DIY underground. Do I think it's particularly DIY and or underground? No. Like one of the major clubs in Toronto is this place that sells fucking tapas during the day or whatever. And so it's like, yeah, are you really like an underground club? Not really. But it's like, I think there's like an effort there among young people to go out, at least in cities. Like I know there's been these studies recently being like, why don't Gen Z go out clubbing anymore? And it's like, well, it's fucking expensive for one.
Yeah.
But like, I think Brat is very much like a party album. It's an album to be danced to.
I guess
so. I think it's a mixture of those things, but I don't think it has the power to like get us all off our phones forever. You know what I mean?
No, I guess it's just like, what does this look like in the internet age? And I think it involves looking to people who are doing the thing.
I think like everything right now is a bit of a simulacra of the time that came before it, and like the original party scene, like the internet has created a simulacra. You know, you're going out and everyone's taking photos and videos of what they're doing. It's like, it's never going to be the same as it was back in the 90s when people were just experiencing jouissance in the club, but the effort's there, you know?
Yeah. Brat is also an album that's sort of pointing to like niche things and name dropping kind of more niche celebrities, but it's become so wildly popular in mainstream that like it's not really niche anymore. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, she sings about being a cult classic on Von Dutch, and it's like But could you be a cult classic now? Because you're like doing major stadium tours and you're like the pop star of the summer right now. And it mm-hmm. sort of made me think again about that Baffler piece and about cult films and how they exist in today's era. And it made me think about how cult status in a more general sense has changed with the internet. And like, do you think that it's possible for things to have cult status online anymore? Yeah.
Well, I think thinking about Charlie, just as a person, like she did come up through the underground. She yeah. has had this fame, but she's a person who's going to go on living and go on having a career. And so inevitably, if she gets more famous, she will not be cult anymore. Like she's a living, evolving being, whereas like a movie or a piece of media is like a static thing. It exists in one time and place. And what changes about it is how it's distributed, how it's consumed, how we view it, all this stuff. I mean, I've been thinking about that a lot recently, just again with this forthcoming project. Not to be so annoying and be like, big no, things coming. It. But like, it is my biggest thing coming. But I'm of the mind that like, because of the decline of physical consumption of film, like we're never going to have that Rocky Horror cult yeah. moment that we used to, because a movie like that isn't going to be in theaters.
Or if a movie like that does break through, we're going to get TikToks that are like, it's never going to be able to stay like a medium level of known. You know what I mean?
Totally. Unless it's like some, again, like you're saying with Do Revenge, like some obscure Netflix film. But again, it's not going to have that kind of like celebratory, unless no. like Do Revenge starts getting played in like cult theaters later. If those theaters even still fucking exist, and I don't want to be pessimistic, I hope they will. And I think there will be community efforts to save them, like is happening in Toronto with the Review Theater.
That would also be an insane arc for that film. But yeah.
But we don't know. Like, that's what people yeah. would have said about a lot of these cult films, right? So yeah. we have no idea what 20 years will hold about the films we're watching. But yeah, I do think that the lack of, like, physical communal viewing experience has eroded that a bit. I think more what we'll see is, like, the sleeper hit instead. Like a big budget movie that maybe sucked when it came out, but then everyone was like, oh, actually, I like that. And, like, slowly it gets redeemed. But I don't think it'll be the same as it used to. Yeah. Well, all I want to end off on is, the world is burning. Let's dance.